This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Jane Campion's film, The Power of the Dog, opens like a classic Western. This cattle being herded across the sweeping plains, imposing mountains in the distance, we're on a ranch in Montana.
25 years since our first run together. 1900 and nothing.
That's a long time.
Not too damn long.
So the plot of the film isn't exactly a Western. It's an intense drama about two brothers. Brothers who share the business, but seem to be opposites in almost every way. It chronicles what happens when one of those brothers marries and brings his wife and her teenage son to the family home. Jane Campion is a true auteur with a highly personal style, dreamlike, but often brutal. She's found mainstream success telling very idiosyncratic stories. The Power of the Dog is nominated for 12 Oscars, the most of any film this year, including Best Picture and Best Director. Jane?
Yes, hi, David.
I spoke with Jane Campion last week. Well, this film is adapted from a novel from 1967 by Thomas Savage. Why did this one hit home to you? You must go through stacks and stacks of novels, all kinds of source material that might make up a film, and you don't...
It's a brilliant novel. I mean, it's a forgotten, unloved, uncherished book, but I think it's just actually quite brilliant, and you also feel the truth in it. You know, like, this is almost something between a memoir and a fiction, you know, that the way he writes is so detailed and particular that you know he's lived it. You know, it's his lived experience, and it feels like something you can totally trust.
One of the things I assume you have to deal with is you're not only adapting from a particular novel, you're also either up against or aware of a whole tradition of Western movies in the history of American filmmaking.
Yeah.
And how did you view your film against all those many, many, many either genre pictures or John Ford pictures or that whole long and complicated tradition?
Well, I don't understand the whole of the long, complicated tradition, but it is a very romantic genre that all of us, everybody, me included, have fantasies about. What I felt my allegiance to was Thomas Savage's particular story. You know, here I had someone who really did grow up in the West, who was irritated by the romance of the West and found it to be not showing the best of men sometimes, but the worst of them.
Mm.
So he wrote a very particular tale. It's not trying to say, oh, this is the West, but it is a counterpoint, I think, and, you know, and a subversive one to the dominant, I suppose, fairy tale of it, you know?
Now, last week, the actor Sam Elliott, who's played a hell of a lot of cowboys in a lot of Hollywood movies, went on a podcast, Mark Maron's podcast, and Maron asked him what he thought about Power of the Dog. And Elliot really slammed the movie. He asked what a woman, a person from New Zealand, knows about making Westerns, why you'd shoot in New Zealand, and in general criticized your portrayal of cowboy life.
Yeah.
Do you have any response to that? Do you care?
I love Sam Elliott. He's he's a wonderful actor. And, you know, I understand that from his point of view of playing classical cowboys and feeling like in some way he and his cohorts own that genre. It must be disturbing. But, you know, I have to point out that there were women in the West as well. They weren't all whores or whatever else. And, you know, there were plenty of women that were watching and had very different points of view about how things were happening. And also that Sam, I don't know how old he is, but I'm sure he wasn't there and around in 1925. And he sure as hell wasn't living on the ranch that Thomas Savage was living on or in his skin. And so I think it's, you know, that problem of, you know, a certain generation of men having problems accepting other people's points of view.
Now, your films are not always, but usually centered around female leads. I don't know what the arithmetic is there, but it's more often than not. Here, this is not the case, although obviously Kirsten Dunst has a big role in this.
Yes.
Was that a particular interest in pursuing a more male-oriented story, or it was just by the by?
It was a kind of casualty of just falling in love with this book. I mean, it wasn't lost on me either. Like, oh, my God, here we are, my first male lead, and what a guy, you know? So and I thought about it a little bit because, you know, I think being one of the few female directors out there for some time, I did used to feel very strongly that I needed to keep telling stories about women that meant something to me. But I think with the advent of Me Too movement, that, you know, things have really changed, and they have, you know, really changed for the better. You know, for a very long time there was an extraordinary lack of equality for women in our industry, and their systemic abuse, you know, didn't feel like an urgent problem or even a problem. And that change, I feel it extremely, and I think it's emboldening a lot of women to do whatever they want to do. And, you know, I think there's a kind of fearless urgency that is producing some really interesting work from women that came about because of, you know, their support by both, you know, men and women. And, you know, and that sort of shift, that dynamic shift in the industry, which is a bit like the Berlin Wall coming down.
And it's that market. You feel it.
The statistics are so stark. They tell the story anyway. But to tell it in a human way, this is how I would recount it, as someone who lived through it, you know, who's been in the industry for 40 years, that the inequality was noted, but it wasn't urgent, you know?
Yeah, you had experience with Harvey Weinstein, about which The New Yorker and The New York Times did a lot of reporting.
Yes.
And you worked with him pretty closely on The Piano, and were you...
Well, I didn't work closely with him on The Piano. No, he bought it when it was finished.
So did you have much contact with him?
Well, I mean, I live in Australia and New Zealand, and he lives in New York. I did work on Holy Smoke with him, and it was a pretty horrendous experience.
How so?
Because he didn't like the story, which is really not surprising when you think about it. And you think about what Holy Smoke was about, which is... young girl taking on a man who, you know, fancies himself as a cult breaker, and but has a crush on the girl, and the girl doesn't like him, and, you know, fancies that she's going to teach him a bit of what it feels like to be a woman treated in that way. Mm. And anyway, he really hated the film, and, you know, maybe it, you know, I don't know if it was because the film was actually bad or not. I think probably it's okay. But he wanted me to change it, and, you know, he really just screamed down the telephone at me, almost like a shark attack.
A shark attack.
And I can just remember saying to him, Harvey, why are you speaking like this? This is so uncivil, you know. You can't talk to people like that. It's horrible.
That turned out to be the least of it, almost.
Well, yeah, I never actually suffered any sexual abuse from Harvey at all. He wasn't interested in me in that way. But I just didn't know it was so systemic, you know, like it was happening to so many people.
Yeah. Jen, I want to play a clip from the film. Your films often center around characters that have some quality that makes them, let's just say, hard to love. And Phil Burbank is certainly that. And he and some of the other farmhands are sitting down to dinner, and they're being served by a young man named Peter, played by Cody Smith McPhee. And we'll hear Phil making fun of the way Peter is holding a napkin.
Now, gentlemen, look, see, that's what you do with the cloth.
It's really just for wine drips.
Oh, got that, boys. Only for the drip. Now get us some food.
And the thing is, as the film progresses, you find some empathy in him. He changes somewhat. Where did you draw from in imagining Phil's character, or is it all there in the novel written out for you?
I think it's an alchemy between what was imagined and written by Thomas Savage and who Benedict is as an actor and a man in his interpretation. I think Benedict can really open up in an extraordinarily beautiful way to his emotions that if he wasn't able to do that, would it be a very different portrait. But I think he brings us into the sort of dark, treacly, disturbed heart of Phil, you know, which is, so lonely and vulnerable and yearning for a full life he can never lead because of who he is.
He sounds like, Benedict Cumberbatch sounds like an incredibly intense artist, and you have formed over time very intense relationships with various leading
You say
actors.
Intense like it's a scary thing.
Well, I gather that he is very much of in the modern sense, a method actor. What was the reality of that?
Benedict is everything. He's very funny, and he's very personable, and he's very affectionate and warm-hearted. Because he and I agreed and I asked him to stay in character on this set because it's such a long way from who he is, and it helped all of us to know that Phil was on set, you know, and so that if he, you know, he would argue with me sort of as Phil, you know, and about what we were going to do. And he likes, I think, Ben to have a dialogue that goes on, like he's got a monologue in his head that goes on and then it becomes verbal, you know. He verbalizes it and he starts to talk about the options, this, that, and he really is thinking of every possible, you know, variation that you could do on any scene. And at a certain point, you know, like I accompany him in this because it seems like something that is his process. And then after a while I go, oh, let's just do it, eh? You know.
So even when he's having lunch or talking with you about various parts of the film and the cameras are not rolling, he's in character. He's not the kind of posh Englishman that we kind of know from red carpet interviews.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have lunch together, but we had many social events together. No, on set he was Phil, and it really gave him, you know, that beautiful space to just not have to be the nice actor guy, you know, celebrity that everybody wants a picture taken with. And One of the requests that I had during rehearsal was that he every day said no and never said thank you, you know, for as many things as possible. So he just lost all responsibility to politeness, which he said actually was a great freedom. I enjoyed it.
Now, you've had an astonishing career and you continue to make just amazing work. You've had big hits, you've won big awards, revered by your peers, and you haven't had to make a Marvel movie yet. I wonder if it feels that way to you. What's missing from the picture I just painted of your career? What have been the real obstacles and downsides?
I am, you know, like a loner and also a really sociable person. So I really love working with colleagues and having fun. I mean, you know, my idea about life is like, you know, the best thing you can possibly do is laugh, you know, and I just love laughing. I love people make me laugh. So the big hole is comedy. I would it would be really fun to be a comic or a comedian or make films that make everybody laugh and be able to sit there in the cinema and just hear people really have some belly laughs, you know. I mean, I'd love to just be there while Ab Fab and all that lot do their stuff or the bridesmaids crew, you know. I'd do anything just to be on those sets, you know. Because as I say, you know, I think that, you know, there's nothing more wonderful than laughing.
Jane Campion, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, David.
Jane Campion is the director and screenwriter of The Power of the Dog. It's been nominated for 12 Academy Awards, and that ceremony, of course, takes place on March 27th. And next week, we'll present one of the most important rituals in cinema. We'll give out the coveted awards known as the Brodies, recognizing the most visionary films of the year, according to The New Yorker's Richard Brody. I hope you'll join us.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.